I have nothing positive to say in this moment because I don't want to be here. But I'm responsible to be here because it wasn't just Dr. King and people dressed nicely who marched and protested to progress this city and so many other cities. It was people like my grandmother, people like my aunts and uncles who were members of SCLC and NAACP, and in particular, Reverend James Orange, Mrs. Alice Johnson, and Reverend Love, who we just lost last year. So I'm duty bound to be here to simply say that it is your duty not to burn your own house down for anger with an enemy.
That was the great Atlanta rapper Killer Mike talking at an emotional press conference Friday as demonstrations and riots broke out in the Big Peach and all across America, sparked by the police brutality killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hey, y'all.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Hi.
Nice. I guess the best way to set this up is just to read a bunch of Reason headlines from over a terrible, terrible weekend in American life. Minneapolis police killed George Floyd, then failed to protect property owners from riots. Let's see. Black civilians armed themselves to protest racial violence and protect black-owned businesses. Police and rioters get violent at protests in cities nationwide. DC cops kept herding protesters into harm's way. Nation's cops seem determined to demonstrate why people are protesting them in the first place. I got tear gassed at Baltimore's City Hall. Trump can't designate Antifa a domestic terrorist group, and it's a bad idea anyway. The rise and fall and rise again of the outside agitator story. And finally, from this morning, from Elizabeth Nolan Brown, videos show police aggression against protesters across the country. Here are two ways to help it stop. We live between us, two of us in New York, two of us in Washington, D.C. Catherine, you are in the middle. Both of you guys actually are in the kind of the middle of Washington, D.C. Let's just start by saying and hearing about what you witnessed or observed sitting in your perch near-ish the epicenter of one of the worst conflagrations yesterday and over the weekend, Catherine.
So we had a literal conflagration, which was also literally a dumpster fire here, which feels exactly right somehow. Some people lit a dumpster on fire in front of the White House. Our own Elizabeth Nolan Brown was there to witness that on the ground. I was not there because I was in my house. There was not anything really audible or visible from where I was. And I think that that's actually something that a lot of Americans are experiencing right now because they know that their city. Oh, can you hear the sirens in the background? Hold on.
Yeah.
Let me wait so we can drop those out, even though it is kind of atmospheric.
I mean, I'd keep it.
Yeah.
Go on.
Even though people know that there is violence. And when I say there is violence, I think it's really, really important for us to say here that it's police violence. I mean, there are people looting. There are people rioting. We can talk a little bit about the complicated dynamics of whether it's Antifa or Black Lives Matter or just ordinary people and whether that changes our view of the violence. But it's also police violence. Police in Washington, D.C. were filmed, you know, using their vehicles aggressively, using their riot gear aggressively. Elizabeth Nolan Brown witnessed a bunch of it. So when we say there is violence in America, I don't want anyone to get away with suggesting that it's just a bunch of troublemakers. It's the police who are currently a bunch of troublemakers, at least many of them. So I didn't see anything. And yet I know that this violence is very, very close. And I guess that's the piece of this that is a little bit hard for me to sort out, is it is both true that America is burning and it is true that most of America is completely fine. And I'm not 100% sure how to mentally wrangle that or what it means for instance, questions of whether the president should address the nation or whether there should be citywide curfews. My inclination is to say no, whether there should be statewide curfews, as in the case in, I think, Tennessee. So I am sad and confused. But one thing I'm not confused about is that this is a super obvious moment to make some long overdue reforms that Reason has been advocating for a long time, including and especially reforms to the way that we handle police who have behaved badly or criminally.
I should, building on your point there, Catherine, about the difference between, you know, what you read and see and then the lived in reality. I think it was Thursday or Friday night, there was a reports that there were at least one police precinct on fire in Fort Greene, and which is not that far from my house, close to Barclays Center in Brooklyn, and another one close to it. And so it was a nice night, and I figured, oh, let's go out, take a walk, and have a look. And I walked over to one of the two embattled streets and saw absolutely nothing. A nice 90-minute walk on a pleasant afternoon when there were riots all around me and like texts from my nieces who I never hear from making sure that I'm okay. Am I close to the trouble? And like saw absolutely no problem at all. Of course, I didn't choose to walk outside the last couple of nights because that was probably a little bit more dicey and I've got kids. Nick, what have you observed either in person or just as an as someone, you know, slack jawed watching television and your Twitter feed from New York City?
So I'm in Lower Manhattan in NoHo. The store at the corner of my block, Kith, which is a highly well-known, high-end kind of leisure wear outfit that had emptied its stores. This is a store that is popular enough that on most weekends it has a line out the door, you know, that gets metered in like a nightclub. When the COVID lockdown happened, they took all of the stock out of their store and left the windows open so people could see it was empty. Yesterday, they boarded up their windows. This morning, the boards were pulled apart and the windows were smashed. I heard last night, as well as previous nights, both on Bowery and on Lafayette Street. I wouldn't say there were protesters because they weren't protesting. There were people running up and down the street smashing stuff and spray painting stuff. That's, you know, what I've seen. I did a tour this morning. I walked around Soho and on Broadway between Houston Street and maybe Broome Street. At least a dozen stores were had windows smashed, a lot of spray paint. A police vehicle had been burnt out on the street. So there's a lot of that. I am having difficulties coming to grips with here is a couple of things. One is that the good thing that came out of Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed, and you know, there's nothing good that comes out of it. But nobody defended the police. Nobody defended police tactics. Even various police unions, as Reason reported, walked away from this. They said this was absolutely unacceptable behavior. There is movement to get rid of things like qualified immunity and to change police union contracts to make it easier to get rid of bad apples. The cop who has been indicted over the death of Floyd had at least 10 bad incidents before this. That's all good. I went back and I looked at, you know, what was happening when we covered Ferguson years ago. It was a totally different response where a lot of people were defending the police. A lot of people were defending policing tactics. That is all gone. And I think we need to recognize that there has been actual measurable and immense progress since then. And at the same time, I find it deeply, deeply problematic that people are willing to say protests, yes, looting is okay, rioting is okay. I think that's really fucked up. Yesterday, I also was in Times Square in the late afternoon when a protest march started walking down Broadway and 7th Avenue from Times Square. And again, it was absolutely vocal, peaceful, loud and proud as it should be, pushing back against things like police brutality. Within a couple blocks of marching down the street, it went from being, you know, no justice, no peace, or stop police brutality to NYPD, suck my dick, all cops are bad, et cetera. And that's a rhetoric that is, you know, to go back to the Killer Mike clip that you were playing, we need to define what are the parameters here of what is good pushback and what is just, you know, screwed up lawlessness. That really can't be tolerated, I think.
Peter, what did you see there in what's the name of your neighborhood? You don't live in Shaw. What's the gentrifying nickname for you? Bloomington.
I live in the Bloomingdale Eckington
neighborhood about a mile and a half north of the Capitol. So if I step out and walk about 50 feet from my house, I have really a very nice view of the Capitol from the north. My neighborhood is fine, as far as I can tell. And on Saturday, there was a socially distanced farmer's market. People were out for jogs and taking their dogs for walks. It was a beautiful weekend. The farmer's market was on Sunday. But it was a beautiful weekend all weekend. And there was, you know, sort of a big disconnect between the kind of the calm and relative normalcy of the daytime and even of Friday evening, because one of the things that happened this weekend was DC started its phase one reopening plan. And so Friday at 5 o'clock after work, I took my dog for a walk and walked by the local tavern that has been closed to people eating on site. So you've been able to get pickup, but no eating on site. And they finally have their patio open to eat. And so they've got their tables spread out so that only every other table can be sat at, but you can go and you can sit and have a hamburger and a beer. And I think there's a 2-hour limit or something on it, but you can go and actually get food and a beer at a restaurant now. And I watched this scene that was both weirdly beautiful and kind of just surreal and sad at the same time, where at 5:01 p.m., a young couple comes and sits down on the patio, and they're both wearing not just masks, but they're wearing bandanas, right? So they look, you know, like highway robbers, except they're like, you know, 25-year-old hipster types. And they sit down and they get their beers and they toast and they pull their masks down and they have their first beer out in 2.5 months, and it might have been the first one served in Washington, D.C., because it was really exactly at 5 p.m. on Friday, the first day that things were reopened. And so there was this feeling at the beginning of the weekend that, wait, maybe we were just going to put a pinky toe over the line back into normalcy. And then, of course, Friday and Saturday and Sunday night happened, and it was just, wait, nope, we're not doing that. And while I didn't see anything myself, there were sort of two parts about the weekend evenings and you know, what was going on here that stood out to me. One was, with the curfew, things were really, really quiet, even more than usual. And there just was no traffic, nobody out walking. And that has been more true than... I mean, it has been relatively quiet since the lockdown started, but the only thing you're hearing after 10 p.m. or so is sirens. That's it. And that's very strange for my neighborhood. But then the other thing is, I watched all of this happen on Twitter. I had CNN on in the background, but I was watching images of looters hitting the mall where one of the movie theaters that I go regularly for screenings is up towards the Maryland border. I was watching images of cars burning maybe just a little more than a mile away from me around the new Apple store at the convention center. I was watching, you know, images of just stuff on fire all over the city. And while I couldn't see it from here, it was very surreal to just sort of be sitting here hearing nothing except sirens and watching images just sort of pass in front of me, scattered, you know, some from mainstream news sources, some just from people who are out and about, and seeing parts of my city that I go to regularly, that I walk through, that are part of my life, that have suddenly become battle zones, you know, and set on fire.
Catherine, there's a talk pretty early on in the quarantine lockdown coronavirus days about how there's no libertarians in a pandemic, to which obviously Nicolespie says there are only libertarians in a pandemic. But can we apply the same kind of puzzler to riots? What does the libertarian say during a time of riots, when the rioting is against the cops, man, and police overreach and the militarization? And my God, did you see them marching down in Minneapolis, just stone cold shooting people for standing on their porches? It was crazy. And yet they're also trashing private property. What say you, libertarian, during the middle of a riot?
Yep. I mean, just like there are, in fact, libertarians in a pandemic, though I would maybe disagree with Nick that we are all libertarians in a pandemic. There are, in fact, libertarians during protests/riots. I mean, I think this is, I actually was really, really struck by this thing that I know, but then I forget, which is that to me, one of the most important distinctions almost all the time, everywhere in the world, is what things, or I'll say everywhere in the United States, what things are public and what things are private. The idea that there is private property and there is government property or public property. And the fact that that distinction is not important to most people. Like, I would even maybe argue that this is a crucial thing about the way that libertarians view the world, because it comes up everywhere. It comes up all the time. And one of the examples is, you know, when we say, oh, are we going to regulate speech on the internet? Well, what is censorship? When Twitter puts a fact check on Donald Trump, when Twitter, you know, shadow bans someone, was that censorship? And I say, no, it's not censorship, because, of course, Twitter is a private company and can do what they like. But it would be censorship if the government did it. And when you see people righteously and correctly outraged about police misbehavior, expressing that by ruining a CVS, it's a reminder that people don't see public and private. They just see power, I guess, or they just see bigness, or they just see what's in front of them and they're angry. I'm not sure. But that, to me, is the kind of the libertarian look at this is to say, one, the protesters who are out protesting police misbehavior have a really, really good point. Wow, do they have a good point. And I think that has led some people to try and do this thing where they say, well, there's the real protesters, and then there's the people who are just looting. And I don't think that the protesters themselves divide that clearly mentally into two categories. I think there are people who are really, really protesting this real problem, who are really angry, who just don't see exactly why it's not an appropriate response to tag a Starbucks or smash a window. And to me, that insight is because there's a big difference between the government and people just trying to run their businesses. But I don't know. The lack of appreciation of that distinction has long frustrated me in many public policy areas, and I was thinking about it a lot this weekend.
There's a class thing going on, I suspect, here, Nick, and as someone who's easily inflamed by class rage.
Second only to generational.
And
self-hatred. This one, the class hatred is projected outward. The generational hatred is projected inward, man.
There's a guy who's a pretty good Twitter follow who writes about police issues named Peter Moskos, M-O-S-K-O-S, and he made an observation that I think rings kind of true, which is that you have over the weekend a lot of kind of upper middle class educated white protesters standing in the face of middle class, working class minority cops or cops or people of color and telling them that they're racist. there's something kind of weird going on. And I'm curious about your sense of that, or the kind of court awareness of that. I find myself, and maybe this is, New York has gotten to me because New York is a cop city very much, but the instinct that a lot of people, including a lot of libertarians, have of like, well, of course cops are racists. Of course cops are pigs. Of course cops are fill in the blank, as opposed to, of course cops have too much power and use it too strongly. Seems to me that we're getting to a collective demonization problem that actually steers us away, diverts us from a power analysis that would actually lead to better reforms. What's your sense of all that?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with you in that last statement that, you know, if we want to talk about a kind of power analysis, we're not going to learn that much from Middlebury College graduates screaming at an NYPD who they know is going to be restrained in many ways, as opposed to 50 or 60 years ago, that is 55% black, or black and Hispanic or non-white. I also want to caution, it's easy to draw conclusions and say, oh, well, you know, like it's a majority of people marching are white, and I assume they all went to elite private liberal arts colleges, so fuck them. That's sloppy and lazy until there's actual data that suggests any of that. And I think there's, you know, a couple of things that shouldn't be that difficult to hold in our minds at the same time. And one is that there is absolutely legitimate rage at the perpetuation of racial disparities in the way communities are policed. And it's true that of the 1,000 people a year that cops kill, 30% are black, whereas they're only 13% of the population. There's something endemic and wrong there that needs to be addressed and is being addressed. I think at the same time, there's also a very clear distinction to be drawn which gets hazy in certain contexts, but between people who are protesting that and people who start smashing windows and tagging buildings, because you don't go to a protest for police brutality with spray paint unless you're planning on doing something that is not, you know, the type of lawful, legal, or ultimately effective protest. And, you know, and we need to recognize that. And I think, Matt, to get to your larger point, there's a narrative that has been gaining ground, you know, in common conversation. And you can look to things like the 1619 Project, which just won a bunch of national magazine awards and a Pulitzer Prize and all of that, which says that America is irredeemable, that America is a white supremacist nation, and that everything that we do, and every black cop and every Hispanic cop and every minority who's in the power structure upholds a white supremacist order. If you believe that, the only possibility going forward is revolution and burning it all down, because you can't reform something that is fundamentally supremacist, et cetera. I reject that. I think that's an absolute massive misreading of American history, but especially of the past 50 or 60 years. And we have to engage that debate and say, no, you know what, you're wrong. And there are people of good faith, not the, you know, the freakazoid Trump-tards who are going to say nothing is wrong. And in fact, you know, the more that you provoke people to act out in violence, the more it proves that we need Donald Trump more than ever. That's wrong. But so is the idea that America is somehow irredeemable and that there has been little or no progress over the past 50 years or even over the past 5 years. And I think that's where we need to be. And that's where the vast, vast majority of Americans are.
Peter, building on Nick's well-said point there, you cover healthcare. So I'm going to read you the lead paragraph in the lead story of the New York Times newspaper. All the news that's fit to print is the motto of the New York Times.
I've heard of it.
So they say they are parallel plagues ravaging America. The coronavirus, period, and police killings of black men and women. As a healthcare reporter, does that strike you as an accurate rendering?
Well, one is a literal plague and the other one is metaphorical. I'm not sure what healthcare policy expertise has to add to this particular conversation.
Thank you for the question. I have trouble with metaphors, so like it's.
I mean, you know, we're building on Nick's point. I think it's right to say that people. That there is a school of thought out there that appears to be gaining influence or traction that says that the whole country is completely irredeemable. At the same time, I do think it's worth raising the possibility that within particular institutions, there is systemic cultural rot that is in some way irredeemable, that is a cancer that needs to be removed by force, right? That it needs to be irradiated the hell out of there. And that is not to say that I am in any way endorsing violence, because
cancer by force.
When I say by force, I mean particular actions need to be taken. I mean that it's not just sort of going to kind of fix and heal itself, that things don't just sort of basically go away, get better. In some cases, they do. And I guess I'm specifically talking about police unions. And the police union problem seems just to be pretty intractable. And police unions exist to protect the interests of police, who are the people who the state has granted the power to use violence against citizens at the expense of the interests of the public. And that means preserving their paychecks, it means preserving their jobs, and it means excusing them from criminal or civil liability for wrongdoing. That's what police unions exist to do. And as long as they exist in that form and exist primarily to do that, to protect police without regard to the kind of the broader public interest, which the police are supposed to be thinking about, then there's going to be a real deep, deep problem within the culture of policing. That doesn't mean that it can't get better in any way. That doesn't mean that there's no kind of room for improvement even, you know, in the current setup. But I do think that the police union problem is a real and serious systemic issue in which there are just, there is deep institutional rot that, that people need to be talking about and need to be dealing with.
I would extend that to say that, you know, there are other, it's not simply police unions, and I know Peter wasn't suggesting that, but there's a whole set of types of laws that, you know, effectively function as means of social control, not to, you know, keep people safe, but to keep certain people in certain places. We've had reason since the inception of the magazine in 1968, we've talked about the drug war and specifically these terms. The drug war ultimately is not about keeping drugs out of the hands of dangerous substances out of the hands of people. It creates a pretext by which you can demonize and lock up large numbers of people of various groups that are disfavored by the power structure. You know, we can talk these terms. You get rid of the drug war, you don't get rid of capitalism. You know, you get rid of civil asset forfeiture. You don't get rid of, you know, the idea of private property, things like that. And that's the conversation that we need to be having. And I worry very much so. And, you know, seeing this unfold in New York, I've talked to friends of mine who live in Philadelphia, in LA. And, you know, when this starts to shift from here are the things that we need to fix in our society versus, you know what, it's all hopeless, let's burn it all down. That's a bad thing. And I think that that is becoming more and more dominant, at least in certain elite circles. And it plays, ironically, it plays into the hands of people like Donald Trump or reactionary populist forces.
Catherine, I am loathe to play ventriloquist with demonstrators and protesters anywhere under any circumstances. I think people oftentimes want, you know, they see what you want to see and hear what you want to hear when it comes to clashes in the streets. At the same time, you, like I, are a parent of kids who have been inside quarantine houses for 2 or 3 months. When you look around, like, I mean, Nick said, like, we should, fix the criminal justice system and not necessarily abolish capitalism. We kind of abolished capitalism, or at least like 30% of it, over the last 2-3 months, when you look and see the kind of pent-up expression of whatever the hell it is out there, how much do you see or feel like the coronavirus kind of quarantine impacting it?
It's gotta play a role, for sure. Again, as a parent whose children are slowly going feral in front of my very face in my living room, like, that my household is not the only household where that dynamic obtains. I've been sort of interested in this conversation that is going on that I think is going to get louder in the next few days, especially if protests and demonstrations continue, which is, okay, so we have the background of coronavirus. We still have an ongoing public health crisis. And Robbie Suave did a post this weekend where he pointed out that we are not hearing a lot from the same people who were the sort of self-appointed guardians of social distancing, both public.
The social distance warriors?
The social distance warriors. Wow. Yes. And this is both government officials and folks in the media who were up on a really, really, really high horse about social distancing. Like, wow, was that horse up there? And we're not hearing a lot about that all of a sudden. And if pressed, those people seem to be saying, well, these protests are important, constitutionally protected political speech about such a vital issue that they simply cannot wait. And that, yes, coronavirus is still a threat. And yes, people should wear masks and be careful. But, you know, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. And those same people rejected out of hand the idea that the destruction of small businesses, the ending of people's livelihoods, the ending of schooling, all of these other things that people were doing in society that were important to them, that we ground to halt in the name of stopping coronavirus, that those things obviously were on the other side of the line. Those things weren't important enough. This is important enough. And you know what? They might even be right. I'm not sure. But I think that this is like a great example of a lack of empathy and toleration that you would say well, it's clear we all agree that it's fine to be in the streets and close to each other for this. And it's clear that all right-thinking people should have agreed that it was not fine to be out in the streets to keep your business afloat, to educate your children, to even get exercise in some cases. And I don't, yeah, I just want, I guess I want to say that, like, there is this kind of impulse to give people a pass when they are doing something that is really, really important. And I agree that at the core, these protests are making a really, really important point. I wish that we had been able to think and talk a little bit more fairly or with a little bit more nuance about whether we could have made more space for people to have economic freedom in addition to this very important political freedom to speak and gather.
Not just economic freedom. Personal religious freedom. I just think it's very difficult to say that it is super obvious that these protests are so important that it justifies violating all of the social distancing rules, and that churches and gathering for religious purposes, which is a clearly constitutionally protected right, are not. And again, I'm not saying that I definitely think I don't know. I think it's a complex issue, but anybody who says that it's very clear that one is totally okay and one totally isn't, I think is not treating it with the complexity that it deserves.
And I do also want to say, like, one of my absolute fave columnists, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, because, oh my God, the world is an amazing place. He did a great piece in the Los Angeles Times this weekend, and he writes, I don't want to see stores looted or even buildings burned, but African Americans have been living in a burning building for many years, choking on the smoke as the flames burn closer. Racism in America is like dust in the air. It seems invisible, even if you're choking on it, until you let the sun in and then you see it's everywhere. Like this, I don't want to kind of minimize the fact that like this, the issues at stake in these protests are indeed genuinely urgent, but I do wonder at the idea that like this has gone really mostly unquestioned in terms of the public health crisis, whereas other, you know, economic and religious activity were widely scorned. Now, of course, the real contrast is probably the people who were out protesting in the state capitals a month ago about reopening the economy. And there, I think you really get into brass tacks because, as people have pointed out over and over, didn't see a lot of tear gas, didn't see a lot of billy clubs, didn't see a lot of people getting run over with police vehicles at those protests. Now, they were smaller. They were smaller, and I don't think we should lose sight of that.
Those
protests were treated differently.
There weren't a lot of, like, 21-year-olds throwing Molotov cocktails into open police cars.
No, I agree. They were different, but they were, well, first of all, yeah, like
corporate lawyers.
21-year-olds, yeah, but also, you know, Harvard law grads. Yeah, I mean, they were different protests, but they were also different protests because they were facing different underlying conditions and different expectations about how they would be met by law enforcement when they protest.
Also true. Before we leave the topic, just sort of throw it open to the court, and I'll start with Nick. Is there any either activity, action, or statement from a government official over the weekend that strikes you as particularly noteworthy?
You know, there have been a couple at the mayoral level, and I think this is, you know, worth thinking about, that in many ways, you know, this is first and foremost a crisis of Minneapolis and in a related way, Louisville, and places where the cities in which police acted, you know, terribly. And also the governors there. This is, I don't think, you know, if Donald Trump emerges from whatever panic room he's in and gives the greatest speech of his life, I don't know how much that's going to matter. Matt, we live in New York. Bill de Blasio, the much maligned mayor, who is just, you know, is a disaster and won an easy second term, because the system is designed to put up mediocrities like him where he can run for as long as he wants to until he, you know, snaps his own hamstring, a complete absence. And that's where you need stuff. You need police commissioners, you need mayors, you need local politicians who actually have roots in a community and can talk to people. That's why something like, you know, again, to go back to the Killer Mike thing at the beginning, he's a member of that community. The mayor of Atlanta, the police chief of Atlanta, have done extremely well in terms of actually being present and visible in their communities. That's where a lot of this is going to, you know, is going to diffuse the problems. And then there are national, you know, level solutions to be made. Justin Amash has tried to, or he's going to introduce legislation in Congress at the federal level to get rid of qualified immunity. That's a good thing. But that's not going to stop the smoke from billowing out of, you know, Grand Rapids or, you know, or Detroit or anything like that.
Let's put a button on this now, because I wanted to make sure we had at least some time to talk about a thing that happened, I think, 5,000 years ago, but also last week, which is...
So like Thursday?
I think it was Thursday, which is that President Donald Trump issued an executive order about like social media and Twitter, and I've already forgotten it. And also Twitter started fact-checking the president's tweets, and Ted Cruz was out there, and Josh Hawley arguing with Justin Amash about what's in Section 230. Peter, can you do a better job than I just did of setting up what the that conflict was and why everyone is stupid except for us?
President Trump issued an executive order that, constitutionally speaking, was like Muppet speak. I mean, it was just total nonsense, garbage in every possible way, to the point that it's not even worth really trying to figure out what it is intending specifically to do. And instead, what you need to know is that this is President Trump escalating the war on social media, specifically big tech in general, and the media in general. Trump has been doing this basically since he started running for president in 2015. He has gone after the Washington Post and the New York Times and CNN. And there has been this kind of running thread throughout his presidency of attacks on social media companies, Facebook and Twitter in particular. But Google sometimes gets brought into this for search result manipulation and sort of lumped into the kind of big tech problem group there. There's a couple of things to sort of just remember very briefly. One is Section 230 is a good thing. It is the First Amendment of the internet. It is what allows all of us to talk and do stuff. It is what allows freely on the internet. It's what allows companies to innovate without permission from the government or legal restrictions that make it basically legal costs that make it virtually impossible for them to do anything. So just sort of thinking about that in 230, I would commend Elizabeth Nolan Brown's piece on this to you from a year or so ago. But the other thing to remember is that this isn't just a Republican war on Section 230 and big tech. This is something that both parties have done. Joe Biden, in, I believe, January, wrote a whole thing in the New York Times about how he wanted to end Section 230 protections. And so this is now a bipartisan war on one of the most important protections and provisions in the governance of the internet generally and of internet speech specifically. And we are now, unfortunately, in a place where both major parties have decided that like I said, the First Amendment of the internet, the thing that protects the ability of individuals to say what they want, to speak freely, of platforms to provide places for people to speak freely or to speak within the rules those platforms set. That law, that regulation is under threat now from both parties, and there is not an option for a president who has not basically said, or there is not an option for a major party president anyway, who has basically said that we want to protect that and we want to preserve what has made the internet work.
If I can jump in on that, Elizabeth Warren just within the past week or so called Facebook a hate-for-profit machine that gives a megaphone to racists and conspiracy theories, because Mark Zuckerberg said that he wasn't going to fact-check political ads and political statements on Facebook. And, you know, to underscore what Peter's talking about, this is the ultimate source of frustration, certainly from a libertarian perspective or for a libertarian, is that you have a system where the two alternatives, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, you know, Josh Hawley and Elizabeth Warren, are absolutely saying the same thing, that certain speech should not be tolerated and the government should be able to dictate what is and is not legal speech. And the system, this is, I think, what is most frustrating, and all of the problems that we're, you know, that are happening now are only going to get worse as the summer gets hotter and the election grows closer. Joe Biden is not an alternative to the status quo of Donald Trump. He is the architect, as much as any politician in America in the past 50 years. He is responsible for the America we live in. So if you hate that America, and there's a lot to hate in it, it's because of Joe Biden. So you're not going to fix anything by getting rid of Trump and voting in Joe Biden. We need an alternative. And it is clear that, at least in terms of electoral and partisan politics, that alternative is not viable. It's not visible. It doesn't exist. That's what we need to create. And these, I hope, are the death throes of a dying beast, of a, you know, of a long 20th century that continues to overpower the ability of us to move into a new world, which abides by different rules, has different types of people in it, and different needs and different desires.
You know, if Twitter is expected to police misinformation and wrong, factually wrong statements that are on its platform, which, you know, is a thing that they could do if they wanted to try. They could do it either systematically or, you know, say only apply it to Donald Trump or to political figures or whatever. But if they're expected to do it, which seems to be the kind of cultural and political push, then Twitter is going to have to cancel pretty much all coverage of the riots and protests, because there's almost no way to sort through what is perfectly accurate in real time. And this is both the benefit of something like Twitter and one of the problems with it. And like I said, I watched the protests and the riots unfold in Washington, D.C. The CNN was on, but mostly watched it through Twitter. And what was striking to me was, on the one hand, you get this kind of panoramic collage of a world in flames, of seeing stuff that I'm not downtown. I'm not all over town. And I was able to kind of simultaneously check on what was going on at the convention center, the White House, see little acts of violence in Tenleytown and Friendship Heights and H Street all over the city. At the same time, you're getting all of these reports, some of which are somewhat accurate, some of which are just completely wrong, not because somebody's lying, but because they're mistaken. And this is just sort of, this is the nature of the beast. There's a lot of flack. There's a lot of stuff that gets put out, some of which is true, some of which is helpful. But it's our jobs as informed readers and as careful readers to kind of help to sort through it ourselves. And expecting Twitter to do that, expecting social media companies to be the arbiters in the there and serve as middlemen for truth, capital T, whatever the hell that is, I think is just a completely crazy idea, especially if you're going to take steps to require it legally.
Catherine, Nick opened fire on the Democratic side of the aisle. Can you just take a moment to tell us why Ted Cruz is so awful on this particular subject? The constitutional conservative, Ivy League lawyer, debate society champion, Ted Cruz is just a piece of flaming garbage about Section 230. Thank you.
I can't tell you who hurt Ted Cruz to make him the way he is, if that's your question. But
wasn't it the Zodiac Killer?
Maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, like Ted Cruz is out here demanding that DOJ investigate Twitter. He's an example, I think, of the kind of, if we can call it this, like the kind of smarty pants Republican take, which somehow thinks that, it's now officially an internet cliche, but it's like, you know, guy who votes for leopards eating people's faces party, surprised that leopards ate his face, right? Like this is what will happen to Ted Cruz and to everyone who supports these kind of provisions. There will be less speech on the internet, less of the speech you like, maybe less of the speech you don't like, but definitely also less of the speech you like. And there is just no way around that. you know, I was thinking about when Peter was talking, I was thinking, I just put together a short list of things that I or other people who were reading Twitter briefly believed over the course of the weekend if you were looking at Twitter. And you can see why people are concerned. I, for instance, saw the video, I think many of us did, of the man in Dallas, the sword-wielding man in Dallas who had the absolute daylights beaten out of him by a bunch of protesters. And the closing shot of that video was him broken on the ground. And like wildfire, you know, this man is dead. Will there be justice for him? That man was not dead. That man was not even terribly, terribly, terribly severely wounded. It was horrible, but he was not dead. And everyone on Twitter was just smashing that retweet button yesterday evening. St. John's Church, the historic church across from the White House, was on fire. That Antifa had definitely lit this historic church on fire. Lincoln's pew was burning. No, it wasn't. There was a small fire outside, and there was a fire in the basement that may or may not have anything to do with the protests. A woman on Twitter was describing how to pull down the Washington Monument. This was a historic archaeologist who specializes in ancient Egypt and who was very, 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 very clearly tweeting about, in case you wanted to pull down a small obelisk that was devoted to Confederate soldiers, just hypothetically, here was how you would do it, because here's how they did it in ancient times. She was not writing about pulling down the Washington Monument, for crying out loud. At the same time, I was also horrified by that video of people being shot on their own porch by the police with paint pellets in Minneapolis. That was true. People were being shot on their own porches by police. What the heck? And there's plenty of other footage of business owners getting beaten or attacked for defending their businesses. I didn't immediately know which of those things were true, but neither did anyone else. And there is no way for some godlike omniscience in the person of, I don't know, like Tom Cotton or Josh Hawley or Elizabeth Warren to sort that out and only allow the true things to go. And so what will happen is that all of us would have been much, much, much more in the dark, much more information poor if anything like the vision of these 230 limiters was put in place.
Thank you for that. Let's go to our end of podcast, what you have been consuming in the media. And I'm going to violate my own rules by at least referencing.
Are you about to do it too?
Just going to reference
Matthew Welsh.
Just reference How that dare. It was an interesting weekend to have experienced after having watched the New York documentary by Rick Burns, episode about the draft riots in New York City, which I'd known about, but oh my God. Ugh. Anyways, I'll talk about my own one later. But Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I was consuming, as many people in America were consuming, the successful launch and docking of the SpaceX NASA collab at the International Space Station, including the successful landing on a floating barge of the Falcon rocket so that it can be reused. Holy moly, it was so cool. It was so cool, guys. I know everything is bad, but like that was a really, really good 20 minutes. And like every...
I mean, if we're redoing 1968,
yeah,
right?
At least we have space.
We might as well. We better well have the rockets to go along with it.
Some gosh darn space. It was inspirational. It was beautiful. The happiness of the people in that room. The happiness of the people in my Twitter feed. Just incredible.
Happiness of the astronauts.
The happiness of the astronauts, first and foremost. I'm sure they were glad. And of course, the key social media response was like, congratulations to those two dudes who picked the correct day to leave this planet, because that is not wrong. But I will say my mood was such that when I went to bed Saturday night, I was like, probably something's going to go wrong with the docking. Like, I was, like, scared to wake up on Sunday morning to see if they had, in fact, 19 hours after the launch, successfully docked with the ISS. But they did. And then we were treated to the beautiful video of these two dudes floating into the ISS in their, like, dad khakis. Like, I don't even know what that was about. Like, they were both dressed as if they were about to mow the lawn. And like, okay, I guess that's how astronauts dress.
It was Sunday. They were at, that was a Sunday golf game situation.
So yeah, I just, again, like, I know that we have struggled for some good news. To me in particular, this was such a cool example of an actually successful realization of the dream of Reason Foundation founder Bob Poole. It was a public-private partnership in which everyone benefited hugely. This was NASA working together with SpaceX. I don't like NASA. I do like SpaceX. But you know what? They did it together. I also found it very striking how careful the branding was on everything. Every single thing. The screen was split perfectly down the middle, and there was SpaceX branding on one side and NASA branding on the other side, and sometimes one person in the middle whose affiliation was unclear. And it was carefully orchestrated, competently done. It was just a pleasure to see everyone doing their very best job, from the engineers and the astronauts all the way up through the broadcasters. Rockets! Yay!
That was beautiful. Nick, what have you been consuming?
I watched the Amazon Prime Video series Upload, which is from the guy who helped create the American version of The Office and Parks and Rec. And it takes place in 2033, or the near future, when people who are dying can upload their consciousness or some version of themselves to a virtual reality where they live. And depending on how much money you have, you can be in a better kind of sandbox or not. And what I like about it, it dropped at the beginning of May, right as Westworld, I think what everybody would agree, was a generally disappointing season of Westworld. This is, you know, which was an interesting near future series about what happens next in terms of augmented or auxiliary consciousness and whatnot. This show, which is not quite, it's not quite gelling just yet, but it kind of explores what life is going to be like over, you know, as we get to digitize ourselves and expand our experiences through virtual reality, auxiliary reality, and whatnot. And it's a good show. None of the episodes are perfect, and it has both a crime plot as well as a number of love plots, corporate, anti-corporate, pro-corporate stuff in it. Each episode I found raised a bunch of questions that were worth thinking about. So, Upload.
Peter.
I watched The Vast of Night, a new movie available on Amazon Prime Video. It is the debut film from director Andrew Patterson, and is this little tiny period sci-fi drama in which a telephone operator and a radio like a call-in host in a small town in New Mexico in the 1950s, hint, hint, hear mysterious sounds coming over the broadcast systems and have to figure out what is actually going on. You can probably guess it's New Mexico in the 1950s, but it's handled so well and shot so beautifully. It's just a sort of, it is a real technical accomplishment, especially for a first-time director working on a very small budget. But it's also a movie that does some interesting things with looking at history, because it's really built around a couple of big storytelling set pieces in which the characters, after we get to know our main pair, they end up hearing stories told first by a Black veteran who talks about the way a project that he was involved in, a mysterious project by the U.S. military that relied on Black and minority labor, in part because they assumed that if Black men were telling the stories about what they did, no one would believe them. And then we end up talking to an older woman who talks about being a single mom and sort of what that was like at the time. And so it's this very interesting kind of period portrait that in some ways, you know, critiques the era without being just sort of a full-on kind of snotty, oh, if we only knew what we, you know, we obviously know they were so horrible back then. And it's sort of an interesting exercise in nostalgia at a distance. And it's also just really well made. And so, you know, it's not quite the big budget sci-fi film that we might normally get this time of year, but it's a pretty good stand-in. And if you like smart, well-made science fiction movies, I would highly recommend it.
So my entry here is something that my kids actually have been reading. I have a 5-year-old and an 11-year-old, and the 5-year-old weirdly has taught herself how to read, which is great because we get to take credit for it. But there's a series of graphic autobiographical graphic novels by an artist named Raina Telgemeier.
So good. Those are so good.
Smile, Sisters, and Guts are, I think, the three main ones there. And the one that I read along with my 5-year-old was Guts. And it's just basically about a little girl, like, dealing with life. Very intimately, like, just the minutiae of what it's like to be stressed out by social situations in middle school. And it's just very impressive. Like, you know, she's, I think, must be about 40 years old, the author. And I'm a little bit older than that. But like she must have been keeping notes at the time, because I can't possibly begin to remember all of the just generalized terror about the world around you. And, you know, as since she's portraying someone who is herself, of course, but who's a 10 and 11-year-old, and I have an 11-year-old around the house, it's just really good. It's a good thing for kids to like, and adults can also enjoy it too. So check it out. Raina Telgemeier, the one that I read over the weekend was Guts, which is just, you know, an 11-year-old so stressed out that she, like, doesn't want to eat and, like, is feeling nervous. And it's just kind of weirdly great. Catherine, you are a fan of this, or your
yes,
kids?
My 9-year-old probably has read those, like, 20 times each. I mean, just like, and they were kind of a cult thing at her school back when there was school. They were like the most requested books from the library, and they had to like buy extra copies. I do think they're just a really, really excellent series. And also in my house were like a real kind of gateway to like the kind of voracious independent reading that, again, as a parent, you would like to figure out how to encourage, but actually has absolutely nothing to do with what you do and everything to do with the right kid and the right book in the right moment.
Yes. The 5-year-old, who is otherwise as useless as a human being can possibly be, can wow. Well, I mean, the present company accepted, can entertain herself for 2 hours by herself, staying up at night or even in the middle of the day reading these things out loud. It's wonderful. Anyways, that's all the...
That's how I felt about Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns, which an aunt of mine gave me at 8 years old.
Oh, dear God.
I literally read that thing so often that the pages were falling out and like I had to hold it together with duct tape. And my parents had no idea what I had gotten. I think my aunt sort of did, and she was reacting in part to my parents not allowing me to see the Tim Burton Batmans. And she was just like, well, we'll give him this version instead. And it's was a totally formative moment. And I just spent, I mean, so many hours just reading and rereading and rereading that thing.
I will say, meanwhile, though, my 6-year-old is just reading and rereading the Dog Man comics, which are really,
oh yeah,
they are, I will say, yep, a document for our time, since it is literally about a dog-headed police officer who is just really like it's a police officer whose brain is a dog's brain. So just you could
she's
take,
pretty good at sniffing out trouble, but also gets distracted by like
literally
some chicken wings left on the ground.
If you weren't the best cop.
Literally, the bank robbers in the city just roll balls away from the crime scene, and the cop dog runs away. So just you can interpret that recommendation however you want, but like Dog Man, a comic for our moment.
And weirdly, cannot control himself around dead fish.
Yeah. That's correct.
There's just, he's got the dead fish problem. That's all the dead fish time for. Here, this isn't a good time to admit that, like, at age 9, I read consecutively the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy 23 times.
This is the perfect time.
No.
Always a good time to admit it.
Okay. Okay. May us all, let's hopefully next week's better. Bye.